Great place to get started. Thank you, Scott. Good morning, everyone. We've got Jairus, Carl, Keith here. And I think we should start with some introductions. Make sure you throw some money in the jar. I'll just start by introducing myself, Carl Grindel, PhD student over at Georgia Tech in the School of Public Policy, where I work on issues related to disinformation, in addition to mostly cybersecurity related problems around governance and regulations in that space. Let's start to my left.
Hi, I'm Jairus Khan. I work for the Mozilla Foundation. Make Firefox. I don't make Firefox. I work on internet health issues. That includes disinformation, security, the dangers of centralization. Basically, how does the internet affect individual humans, and how can we make it not terrible?
Oh, I got to get your card.
I have many.
I'm Keith Watson. I've been at Georgia Tech over 30 years. I'm the head of information security for the College of Computing. I'm a submarine qualified electronics technician specialized in special operations, cryptography, and signals intelligence. I sponsor the Gray Hat Cybersecurity student organization at Georgia Tech, as well as their Capture the Flag team, Mad Hatters. I host the local DEF CON chapter, which is DC 404. It's every third Wednesday. You should come. It's a lot of fun. Member of Atlanta 2600 chapter. We meet the first Friday of every week, every month in Lenox Food Mall. We hold Capture the Flags twice a month, by the way, DC 44 and 2600. I'm a member of Electronic Frontiers Georgia. I do most of their technical analysis on bills and legislation that are coming out. Co-developer, Network King of the Hills, CTF. I did say we host them twice a month. You should come. It's a lot of fun. That's it.
So I think before we jump into, you know, what's happening or how we can solve this bot space or improve your social media experience, let's talk about the problem. What are some of the ways that you've been analyzing the problem of bots? And while it seems obvious based on the media reporting on the issue, what's the, you know, what evidence have you been following or tracking?
Well, I want to hear what he says, because I know
what I
think.
Yeah, let's start on the Mozilla side.
Yeah, how about Mozilla?
Sure, yeah. So I think my own personal experience, there's a couple different things that I see that I bump into that I find really troubling. One is from kind of the more researchy end of things. There's a fellow at Mozilla named Renee DiResta, and she
I have stuff about her.
Yeah, so she's awesome. She did a lot of work after the election about the influence of what we assume to be state level interference with the American election, and she's done a lot of work on specifically looking at the way that bots collaborate with what appear to be human actors to kind of build a web of disinformation to cause problems during the election. In the last election, a lot of work was put in specifically to disrupt the political activities of Black Americans more than any other individual group. And the network of bots, it's extremely sophisticated. And so on one hand, you have this kind of like state level, it definitely has an intent kind of thing. On the other hand, you have kind of more hard to attribute nebulous activity. There was a study done about the Catalonian independence referendum that happened last year, and it was the largest study of bots largest study of tweets, I should say, because it studied over 4 million tweets that were concluded to be by bots. And in this study, what they discovered is that kind of previous studies had said, okay, well, there's a bunch of bots, they're going to take a bunch of content, put it out into the world, and kind of flood the internet with bad info. They discovered in the Catalonian study that what was actually happening is the bots were figuring out who to target specifically with their content. And they ended up targeting influencers in Catalonia who were for the independence referendum, because those users ended up 100 times more likely to respond or retweet to that content, thereby signal boosting and amplifying the violent and negative narratives that the bots were doing. So the bots were actually tailoring the content to the type of thing that the influencers were tweeting about, using the same language that they were using, because they recognized on the fly they were getting more signal boosting, they were getting more views. So on one hand, you've got that kind of whole mess. On the other hand, and this is anecdotal, but I find very often, and by very often I mean almost every time, that there's something happening on the internet that people are arguing about. Most recently I saw a dumb Twitter argument about the Jeffrey Epstein conspiracy theories, and and there were like three people in violent argument, and I Google reverse image searched all three of their profile photos, and all three of them were taken from news stories about other people. None of them were who they said they were. None of them were like actual humans on the earth, and this happens a lot. And I think it's going to become a lot harder soon to attribute this, because soon people are going to use... have you heard of this person does not exist, the website? Okay, so pull out your phone, load thispersondoesnotexist.com. And what it is it's a neural network, basically. It's an AI that generates a photo of a person.
Oh, yeah.
This person does not exist. They're not real, but it's a real-looking person. And I think it's going to become so easy really soon to make... Yeah, it looks like a person. And every time you hit refresh, it'll be a new person who does not exist. So I think that how easy it is now to identify bots, which isn't super easy, but easy enough, soon it's not going to be easy at all. So
that's hopeful.
Ray of sunshine.
What are you seeing in the world?
I'm sorry, I'm going to make them hide under the bed. Okay. Because of my background, my job used to be to target all your stuff, and that includes the reverse of that, how to make sure you don't get our stuff. So with that in mind, one of the interesting articles, leveraging off what you just said, was in Lawfare in August 5th of 2019, an article came out in Lawfare, "Is the threat of fake science real?" So can you push, since take the anti-vaxxers movement, for instance, you have very, very heated debate on both sides. Can you fuel that debate to make the people angrier? Could you actually try to destabilize the medical industry? Well, that sounds pretty threatening, doesn't it? Right. Yeah, how long has that been going on? Well, I don't know. Let's see. In 1980s, before the internet, the Russians' Operation Infection tried to plant malicious and false scientific studies in the literature to bring out into the open that Fort Detrick had actually developed and spread the AIDS virus. It's called Operation Infection, spelled with a K. By all means, go look it up. That came out, I was not aware of that operation, but I am now. And going back to Rene DiResta, that's another interesting thing. Back in 2014, and I did not become aware of this till a year later, back in 2014, this group called the Russian Internet Research Agency deploys social media weapons. There doesn't seem to be a specific target, so it's unclear as to why the attacks were launched. At the time, we didn't know, or at 2015, we weren't sure why they did it. Unfortunately, it became painfully evident later. Fake news of an accident in Columbia Chemical Plant in Centerville, Louisiana, including a fake YouTube video of the event. At the same time, they tried to leverage all the work that Emory University was using on the Ebola patients that they were treating, and they put out a fake video of an Ebola breakout in Atlanta from the Emory doctors, which shot supposedly at the Atlanta Hartsfield Airport, with including a fake video, and that there was an outbreak in Atlanta. They also did fake news of an unarmed black woman being shot by Atlanta Police Department, trying to capitalize on social unrest after the Michael Brown incident in Ferguson. Now, all of those were noticed, but they, how many of you heard of them? Nobody. But they were noticed. They did pop up in a radar on some tweets. They, people did retweet some stuff. So people did notice. It just didn't really take traction and run. So we're kind of curious. I mean, that's a lot of effort for something that didn't actually produce any tangible results that we could see. So then in 2015, Rene D'Aresta is, whose background, by the way, is looking at disinformation attacks, is working on, in favor of California State Assembly Bill SB 277. That bill was to try to force the kids in public school to get vaccinations. There was this massive social media backlash from anti-vaxxers. It was massive. And she looked at it and said, "Why, that's odd. There aren't that many of them." So she immediately jumped in. And I mean, they're very loud and they get a lot of attention, but there really aren't that many of them. So she jumped in the middle of that and said, "I'm gonna look at some clustering and see how this works out." And in her analysis, she discovered it was a small group of people using fake accounts, using bots, in addition to bots, to spread disinformation and to make it look to the legislature like there was this huge roaring crowd out there of people who were upset about this issue. The bill did pass. It passed in June 30th, 2015. They weren't successful in their attack, but this was an attack by us, on us, by civilians. This was not a state-sponsored action.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, come on in. It's okay.
I'm coming from voting machines. I was just
gonna... Oh, voting machines is at 1 this afternoon. Off. Yeah.
I know. There's no handicapped chairs out front. I'll just go downstairs.
Okay, yeah, I can relate to that. As you notice, I'm in a chair. So so in 2015, the Obama administration noticed that there were these bot attacks going on against the elections. And so they went, "Wait, we know of an expert." And so they ran to Rene D'Aresta, who published this article. It is her background. She published this more out of curiosity and because it was her thing. And they said, "You're a leading expert in this field. Come to us and help us." So she did. So there was. They started doing research into this bot phenomenon. Now, in 2015 of June, June of 2015, the New York Times comes out with an article called "The Agency." This is when I became aware of this issue, and it was about the Russian Internet Research Agency that did the attacks in 2014. So I read the article, and it's about the Columbia incident, the Ebola incident and the shooting incident, and had pictures of the building, interviewed people who worked there. It's a very interesting article. I highly recommend you go read it. By the way, don't do this if you have to actually go to work the next day because you're going to be cowering on your bed with your laptop all night. It's okay. So we read that article. Now, in the meantime, Cambridge Analytica in 2016 actually takes this technology and they get some of the brightest minds in AI and psychology and they one up the Russians. And they build one of the best that I've seen psychological warfare cyber weapons I've ever witnessed. And they used this in the 2016 Ted Cruz presidential campaign, the 2016 Trump presidential campaign, or the candidate campaign for Ted Cruz, and Brexit. Later this came to light. Netflix did a documentary about it called The Great Hack. I highly recommend you watch it. Once again, prepare not to go to work the next day because you're going to be hiding out of the bed with your laptop. That, by the way, what Cambridge Analytica was doing was specifically doing micro-targeted ads to people who were known to be on the border. And you're like, "Well, how do they know they were on the border?" How many of you have a social media account of some kind? Yeah, they know everything. Okay. Who here doesn't have any social media accounts? Wow. Brothers. Yeah.
But bad news. They still know everything.
Yeah. Yes, they do, but operational security is the idea that I'm going to deny the enemy at every opportunity anything they can use for an inference attack. So that's why I don't do it, because I know what can be done with it. So I'm going to make it as hard as possible for them. So anyway, So let's see. We were talking about, I missed it. So go watch The Great Hack that by Netflix. That is the documentary about what Cambridge Analytica did. Of course, when it came to light, there was a great uproar. It was not pretty. I've got a whole list of articles about and papers and Senate hearings and congressional hearings about social media as a weapon. I won't go through all of those. Now, in October 2018, I'm at the Georgia Tech Cybersecurity Summit. One of the breakout sessions was on these social media attacks. So I went to the session. And as I'd had some time at this point, a few years, to think about what were they trying to do with that attack in 2014. In this talk, the people giving the presentation were researchers on that project that Rene D'Arresta was running. Or they were part of the contracted people that were brought in to work on it. And as they're saying this, somebody in the audience raises their hand and says, yeah, but why would they do these attacks? And they're talking specifically about the attacks in 2014. They said, why would they do this? And so I raised my hand. I said, well, as an ex-military guy, I can tell you what it looks like to me now that I've had time to think about it. This is a weapons test. When you test a weapon and you test an enemy's defenses, you want to make sure your weapon works, especially if it's a brand new weapon and you're betting your life on it. You want it to work. You want to see the effect of the weapon, but you don't want to actually provoke a response. You want to see if their defenses pick up on the attack and actually do alert on it, and that's exactly what their weapon did. Our defenses did pick up an alert on it. There was some talk about it. Rene D'Arresta is now investigating it. There's a presentation at the cybersecurity conference on it. So, yeah, we noticed, and their weapon worked. It did get picked up. It did get retweeted. So they just got to up their game. Well, they actually toned it back for that test. They did up their game in the 2016 election. Boy, did they.
Yeah, I think Keith is exactly correct. I think that those early things from the Internet Research Agency, the IRA, they didn't know the acronym was taken, I guess. I think it absolutely was. They were trying to figure out what works and what lands, and you know, possibly in some countries, what's going to work better is here's a fake video of an explosion at a mall, because it's going to be faster for that to propagate than for people to say, oh, my cousin lives near the mall. They said there was no explosion. I think that what the IRA has kind of ended up doing, what they ended up doing in the election, what they've kind of done later is super sophisticated. And a lot of what they're doing is not even necessarily promoting an individual viewpoint. It's not like all of our articles are about how to get Trump elected. They publish stuff about everything. And they would publish things on both sides. So they would publish, in some cases, anti-vax material and pro-vax material. They would publish Black Lives Matters material and pro-police material. In some cases, they organized protests on both sides.
Across the street from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And like this is a real thing. And the thinking is a lot of this is not actually because they want one or of these perspectives necessarily to win out over the other. I mean, they have a preference likely, but larger to destabilize the trust in the institutions themselves. If you can't trust what you're hearing about police brutality or science or election security or nuclear power or anything, if you can't trust anything
or science, yeah,
right, you no longer have those strong institutions, right? If you can't trust your neighbor because you've been hearing over and over and over that, like, people like them, whatever them is, right, whether that's a cop or an immigrant, if you can't trust people like them, it breaks down, you know, the social fabric of the community. And the thinking is the IRA has been really targeting in on how do we do that? How do we take communities, find these issues that people care about, and turn them against each other? And that has kind of been the large thrust of the IRA's work.
Yeah, and I want to be very careful here to explain that I am not speaking for the United States Navy, nor am I speaking for Georgia Tech. These are my opinions and my opinions only. Yeah.
So I wonder, though, in the way where hate is optimized for retweeting, how much the intention is hate versus how much the optimization of the tools is directed at hate, because that's the most successful way of getting your information to spread. So if people don't know, psychological research has indicated that like happy messages on social media don't spread nearly as well as pointing out something that drives outrage. Outrage spreads, you know, it's sort of
right. Exponentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think
news, that's what news is, the unusual. And so unusual, and especially the more hyperbolic the unusual, the better it spreads.
Yeah. I think that when it comes to social media, there are a couple kind of problems that are comorbid there. One of them is that when you look at Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all of this content that you're getting, because you have, you know, more friends on Facebook and more people you're following on Twitter than you can really process, all of these sites decide, okay, what content are we going to show you first? And then they've all got kind of recommended content that isn't people that you're following, but we think you'll like this anyway. And those algorithms use a number of signals to figure out what is it you will like. And one of those main signals used by all of them is engagement. How many people have done something when they saw this content, right? Because if someone tweets and no one does anything with it, probably it's a crappy tweet, is the thinking, right? So, but if someone clicks to like it, or they reply, oh, this was really cool, thank you, or they retweet it, the algorithms think, oh, this is probably content people want to see. Unfortunately, algorithms designed to recommend content that are built around engagement often end up promoting content that people hate. Because if you really hate something, if someone posts something, and you're like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, and is bad and dangerous and or racist and or terrible, you're going to reply and be like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Or you might retweet it and be like, please don't buy products from this bakery, they're terrible. But what you've done is you've engaged with it. So you end up with content that is provocative or negative or otherwise disruptive ends up very much boosted by all these algorithms. So I think that what these bots have done is found basically an exploit in the recommendation engines that feed us most of the content that we see, and they're like, this is how we get to people. This is how we get that boosting.
Yeah, and here's the tough part. There's a paper that came out. If anybody wants any of the links or references to this, come talk to me. I'll give you a card, send me an email. I'll happily send you all the links. I've got all the articles and backups to this. That's one of the things that really annoys me, is when people say things but don't have the evidence to cite. Okay, so I completely forgot what I was thinking about. What was the last thing you said?
Oh, God, who knows? how it's basically an exploit of recommendation algorithms.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, this can roll over into an actual physical event. And that's where I have to take my hat off and look at the weapon that my enemies be built and just look at it and in awe, because it is a thing of beauty to watch, even if it is pointed at me, or us, I should say. How many of you have heard of Pizzagate? That was a misinformation attack. Now, I don't know if that attack, I didn't follow that one in particular to see if that was fomented by one of these bots, but that actually resulted in a physical attack. There was an actual event. Now, one of the things is this guy at a university, it was quite a while ago. Here it is, 2013, fall of 2013. Eric, I'm going to brutalize his name, Gartz, I think is how you pronounce it. He's the professor and director of CPAS, Department of Political Science, University of California, San Diego, published a paper called The Myth of Cyber War, Bringing War in Cyberspace Back Down to Earth. How many have heard of the Cyber Pearl Harbor? Right? You've heard that mentioned? That's the idea that I'm surprised that there was, like, by the way, for those at home, there like three hands went up and two of them were panelists. So Cyber Pearl Harbor is the idea that we are at risk of a cyber attack that can cause significant infrastructural and social damage along the lines of a Pearl Harbor or a 9/11. And that we should be preparing and defending all of our systems for that. The FBI InfraGuard, which I'm a member of, is for what's considered critical infrastructure to defend and try to prepare those types of infrastructure. That includes things like railroads, production facilities, research, power, electricity, that sort of thing. This guy published this paper that changed completely my thinking on this. I was along the lines of the same thing with this cyber Pearl Harbor sort of idea and saying, well, we got to do something about this. This is bad. And then after reading this paper, I went, wow, the guy makes a really good point. If you do an attack that results in the same type of physical damage that an actual bomb would have caused, what kind of response should you expect? Bombs, boots, and bullets. You should expect what's referred to in the trade as a kinetic response. So that means no one's going to actually use an attack of that type unless they can back it up with a kinetic response. But if they've already got the kinetic capability, that means that the attack they would do would be a joint attack, kinetic and cyber simultaneously, which means full out bombs, boots, bullets, combat. That's what the attacks are going to look like. Or are they? Well, actually, they didn't. They've happened. We're talking about them now. The cyber attack used our greatest weapon against us. It's called free speech, the First Amendment. That's part of the problem. You can say whatever you want. So can the Russians. Did I mention it didn't have to be true? I mean, there are some laws about that, but then it goes through the legal system, and last I checked, the guys in Russia aren't going to come to court. So it becomes a really, really hard problem. So, and on top of that, we've got this dilemma. Does free speech and our rights apply to us only or everybody? Well, we say they're inalienable rights. So as a result, we project those everywhere. We demand people give people human rights at every opportunity. We demand free speech in other countries like China. We try to push free speech in their country. We try to push these rights because we believe they're inalienable. So now the Russians say, okay, I'll run with that. I'm gonna use your free speech and I'm gonna say whatever I like and I'm gonna use social media to do it. Try and stop me.
I think it's super interesting to look at because A, I'm Canadian, so we don't have the First Amendment. but B, if you look at something like the promotion of anti-vax narratives by the IRA, assuming that the IRA are state actors, which is generally considered a safe assumption, in years past, if you had a foreign government basically causing an outbreak of thousands of infections of something like measles, which didn't really, had been declared eradicated in the United States already.
That would be a bio attack.
They have words for that, right? And they have conventions about that and generally, and planned responses for that. But the attribution problem and how kind of soft misinformation is when done through bots makes it really tough to challenge.
One of the other interesting aspects here is that Russia's internet policy going like a decade back was one of information sovereignty. Their idea was they were so worried about American media entering the Russian information space, it leaned, anti-Putin. And so they were pushing the United States to say that, countries should be able to control what information comes and goes outside their border. By attacking the United States in the response to this threat, it's very tempting to adopt that earlier sort of Russian notion of information sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Out of a fear that that's the only way to secure our own space, while then losing the opportunity for the world to get that free speech.
And how many of you remember the Morris worm? It's called the internet worm, right? Yeah, I was actually at Georgia Tech when that happened, and we actually had to pull the plug. We had to disconnect from the internet to stop the spread because we didn't understand how it was working at the time. And unfortunately, when we unplugged, we lost our communications with all the other people on the net. What, you mean I should have their phone number? I just chatted him with an email this morning, and it's not working anymore because the server went down because it was an email worm. So that created a big problem. How many of you heard of CERT through MITRE? Yeah, you know where that came from? The internet worm. We said, hey, we need a central location that we can all call and share the information through in the event of an attack like this. But it was after the event.
That way everyone has their phone number.
Yeah. So, that was because of the internet worm. Well, when you're talking about an attack of this nature, they can capitalize. If you get enough past the tipping point, you can really ramp up the outrage on both sides or on all 15 sides at this point of the debate and take advantage of that at a moment's notice. Are we prepared to unplug from the internet to stop it?
It seems unlikely.
Seems unlikely. Not to mention, it's really, really hard. When you disconnect that infrastructure, well, you take down things like, I don't know, banking. That might be kind of important. You can take down lots and lots and lots of, has a huge economic impact. So if you think about it from the Russian perspective, they have been planning, and this is, I am very anti-conspiracy theory. There are actual real conspiracies. I don't want to say that. But people like to run off the edge of the cliff with the lemmings on those, okay? So I want to be very careful not to tread.
That itself is fake news. Lemmings don't run off lemmings, cliffs.
Yeah, I do.
The lemming conspiracy has gone on too long.
Yeah, I do not. I do not want to fuel a conspiracy. But here's my perspective on it as a warrior in this field. The Russians have been planning to have a disconnect from the internet switch. They've been actively working on that. It's been in the news. I don't know if you've been following that. So they're preparing themselves for the ability to disconnect from the net without the impact.
Well, more specifically, to disconnect their internet
from
the wider internet.
From everybody else. That means their infrastructure has to be able to continue functioning even though they're disconnected from the rest of the world. And we're all tied in like this economically, right? So they're kind of planning that. They're planning for that. That's my take on it. Yeah, you had a question.
Yeah, they kind of had to do that just because of all the sanctions that have been levied.
Do we have the throw mic?
Yeah, do we have
the toss mic?
Orange. Who's got
the
orange?
Thank you so much.
So the players at home can play too. Yeah. That's not
one,
on.
One second.
Is it on? I just plugged it in. Or turned it off. It's
all turned up.
That is a toss mic. You can actually toss it to the next person. It's totally cool.
Yeah.
Yes, except for I can't throw.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Try.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, to some extent, they've had to do that because of all the various sanctions levied against them for international banking and such from the previous set of past actions they've done. So it's kind of a win-win for them. They can, they basically need to establish their own separate e-banking system and such.
Yeah, making lemonade out of lemons, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but if it also means, the West can't really counter hit them with this sort of thing.
I mean, the sanctions in question don't really limit their ability to have, peering agreements with, internet service providers ISPs or anything like that. I mean, they're taking advantage of it politically.
Well, I was thinking the various e-commerce things that are sort of locked out of, they need like an alternate e-commerce banking system. They can't access SWIFT. They can't access those sort of things.
Right, but they don't need to develop their own separate internet infrastructure for that, right? Because you've got kind of like this hardware layer, right, where you've got the actual machines connected via wires and undersea cables to each other, right? And then you've got a protocol layer, which is how the machines all talk to each other, and they all do that. And then you've got kind of like the application layer, which is our bank is refusing to talk to your bank because of sanctions. But everything else underneath it is still the same. So they don't actually need to develop their own critical infrastructure to do their own banking because all the layers underneath it are still work the same and still talk the same. But it provides an excellent political reason for them to say, okay, we need internet sovereignty because we're getting locked out of the global economy.
Some of the language around that discussion refers to internet balkanization or alignment. So the infrastructure for the internet was not built to reflect national borders. And so trying to make a conversion to a sovereignty system does change some of the architecture of the internet so that you can get this alignment between laws and the network. But that has a ton of ramifications in terms of the experience of internet users in it being less of a global network and more of a, you know, national experience.
Yeah, and our military's mental model, and as well as our government's mental model of defense has to change. And I say this because at another, I think it was that same conference, at G2RI, there was one of the panelists said something very, very interesting. They were from RSA, and she said that when they talk to our government and say, hey, we're being attacked by the Russians, or we're being attacked, we're having formal attacks against us, and they say, well, you should put in a firewall. And she turned that around and said, no. You're the government. Your job is to protect us. I mean, if they were Russians were invading Georgia, the U.S. Army and the Air Force and the Navy would all attack them. They would defend us. That's what we pay you for. But you see, that's a physical border they have to cross to do that. But on the internet, there's no borders. The Russian spy agency is literally on the internet, your next door neighbor, and they can attack you at will, and no one's there to stop them. And that's the problem, is because of the nature of the internet, you can't shut down every single path to prevent the attack unless you literally unplug the entire thing.
I am going to just suggest that to focus on bots and disinformation, we can disentangle social media, you know, networks themselves from some of the broader internet critical infrastructure. And just to, before we move to further questions, want to get a little solutions oriented. What are social media networks doing to try to address this problem, considering they're one of the bottlenecks in addressing the situation? And if they're not doing anything, what is Congress or law enforcement doing?
Right. So the work being done by social media networks really depends on the social media network. Some networks, like Facebook, were very, very hesitant to even consider the possibility that that their network was used as part of kind of this mimetic warfare, really, by bots, and that bots had as big of a presence on their social media network as they did, and as kind of their later press releases kind of admitted to. Some networks like Twitter have been really aggressive in combating bots, but not necessarily super effective, because they want people to create accounts. And what, 100 people behind a university network creating an account looks a lot like 100 people behind a VPN in a, like a boiler room somewhere working for, a government or a fake news agency. It looks very, very similar. So the social media networks are worried about it, but at the same time, there is a strong economic disincentive to do anything that reduces their user count, that reduces their ability to make money, and that's not a conspiracy theory. They have shareholders, and they need to stay afloat, and that's a tough situation to be in. I think that governments are always going to be, law moves slower than technology, and governments are always going to be a step behind from a policy point of view. The problem we have right now is that governments are talking to social media networks like Twitter and Facebook and everyone else and saying, hey, we have this problem. We need to worry about, the impact bots are having on everything from public health to elections. And social media networks are like, yeah, probably, but Can we get back to you on this? Because we've got our own problems.
We're about sharing cat memes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a challenge.
Sorry, that was quite. I can see while you're on the phone call with the government, and the guy's watching. Oh, look at the cat! You know, I can just see that playing the piano. You know, it's yeah, you know the one. Well, let's talk about the bots for a second. We've been having an arms race with the bad guys. It started out where. Well, first, let me back up a second. Dealing with researchers think everybody's friends and everybody's nice and we're all friends here. So, no, we'll put up a research wiki. It was called a Swiki. It was built on a programming language called Squeak. And they built this wiki and they said, yeah, we're going to make it like open to the world. So we want everybody to just post whatever they want. And of course, you know, we'll all get in there and we'll all talk love and everything will be great. Yeah, it did not.
This is a project at Georgia Tech.
This is a project at Georgia Tech. And researchers, as they want to do, once they finish a project, it must live on in perpetuity. Even though I have no interest on it, I want to move on to whatever else. And so when you say, hey, there's a bit of a problem, you have no security on that, and the bots are all over this thing, start it out with actual physical people going and registering and putting stuff on there. And they did one of two things. They either posted made a link that says, hey, check out my site, and that's to get their Google rankings up, or they did that and hosted their content on our site, because people are less likely to ban Georgia Tech than they are some machine at some ISP. Okay, so they spammed comments, they put actual content there, and quite often it was an actual person at a keyboard. Well, at some point they got wind of this and they started ramping it up and using bots to do this. Well, we got busy writing code to go and look through code and look for things and sniff for keyword searches. And we're trying to build the equivalent of a Bayesian mail engine for sniffing websites. By the way, I couldn't get any researchers to bite on that. We have all these grad students who could do it. And they said, yeah, there's no paper in that. I don't care. So here I have the best minds in the world. And they're like, no, I'm not interested in that. So we're battling against this. And we're as we find them, we take them down. Well, as we're taking them down and we're making them go back and write security into the machines and turn it on, where you have to create an account and you have to go through a Google click key thing, whatever you call it, you know, to get in there, they got more sophisticated. What they started doing, and this was, I marvel at this, they started putting code into the pages that the only time it would actually generate the content is when a search engine looked at it. So if you actually went to Google and did a search for fentanyl site, getech.edu, you'd find all these pages. You click on the page and view the source code, there's not a word of, no fentanyl, nowhere in the content whatsoever. That's interesting. So I go over to the server and I actually look at the site and I search for the word fentanyl. It's not there. Where'd it come from? I mean, the search engine. Okay, maybe that was old content. Well, one of the researchers over at, or information security guys that I work with over at the campus level guys, he got an idea. He went and started looking at it. He changed the agent string in his browser to that of Google's search engine, and presto, there's the content. So they were actually writing code that would inject into the page the content only when a search engine looked at it. Yeah, so we've been in this arms race with these guys. And these guys, they don't have any political agenda. They're trying to steal your money. Case in point, I hate saying stories that aren't true. I'm a member of my neighborhood watch. I run my neighborhood watch. One of the officers who was working with Neighborhood Watch told me that this happened to him, so I'm willing to pass this along. A guy walks into the police station and says, hey, I want to report a robbery. By the way, burglary is when they steal stuff and there's no people involved. Robbery is when there's an actual person. They take your stuff from a person. Okay. Says, I want to report a robbery. I was robbed. They said, really? What'd they steal? Says, they stole my drugs. Really? Really? Oh, that's terrible. When did this happen? Oh, just a little while ago. Do you know where the guy is? Oh, yeah, I could take you right to him. Okay, hold on, let me get some officers. So they get one of the officer I'm talking to and another guy. They get in the car, they take the guy, they go find him, and they say, that's the guy. And they go over and they search him. They find drugs on him. They go, are these your drugs? Yes, they are. They lock them both up, throw them in jail. Okay, now, how many of you have gotten spam saying, would you like to buy Viagra? Everybody. I'm sure it's even you. Yes. They're an equal opportunity bot. And here's what they do. They take your money and don't send you anything. What are you going to do? Go to the police department and say, hey, I was attempting to commit a felony by buying prescription drugs without a prescription from this guy in Russia. He swore it'd be good stuff. And they go, Russia, you say. Could I have your wrist for a moment? And they lock you up, throw you in jail. They don't go after the guy in Russia. So these kinds of bots attacks have steal money, and you realize that even if they use your email to send out email, or they use social media to send this stuff, they send out billions and billions of email. The majority in the 90 percentile, I didn't bring that stat with me, of email is spam.
So I want to open up to questions, but I think good takeaways there are that there is an ongoing arms race between the technologists and law enforcement to address this problem.
Well, there is one other defense.
Go ahead.
This is the one defense that is absolutely, it's the best, but it's the absolute hardest to implement. You're going to have to educate yourself. You're going to have to, and this applies to me too. There are some things I'm very passionate about. I have to lay my passion down and become very analytical and very reasoning and less hyperbolic. And I have to set aside those differences, and I have to be seriously critical of the content I read. I have to distrust first until proven that it's okay. Each individual needs to do that. It's one snowflake does not blame himself for the avalanche.
Yeah, all right, let's open up to questions. I see one there. Thank you.
So, Jairus, you had mentioned earlier on the sort of trap that lies within the engagement algorithm in terms of actually addressing disinformation online.
Right.
I've seen a couple of tools come out. There's the now defunct donotlink.org and I think Rebutter, would link to the content without actually including their URL. Are those tools, you think, the path forward, or is there some other way that us on the user end can address it without feeding these algorithms more engagement for the bad content?
I think it's really, really hard on the user end to have a significant impact on it systemically. I think systemically, the content engines themselves need to change the way recommendation engines work. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately about YouTube and their recommendation engines and the way that their engines can basically provide content to radicalize people because of the way the recommendation engines work. And YouTube has said, okay, we're going to look into this. But I think that honestly, the pressure has to be put on the content engines to really take a look at the impact of what the recommendation engines are doing to their users. You know, you can use things like those tools or Firefox has tools, Chrome has tools, all these browsers have tools to like have private mode or build containers around your browsing. And those are effective to kind of protect you from this larger infrastructure, but they don't do anything to solve the systemic issue. We really have to put pressure on the big companies to take responsibility for the tools they've made.
And there is a slight disincentive for them to even do this, as you were saying before. When there's a firestorm of stuff, y'all are seeing the ads. They're making revenue. So when there's a firestorm, ooh, money, there's the... Do I want to turn the money stream off? There's a disincentive for that.
We have a question in the back.
Yeah, I want to hear a little bit more about the public health aspect, vaccinations, opioids, that kind of thing, and what can public health agencies and practitioners do? On Twitter, I saw recently you Google something about opioids or you click something, they've put up a little thing like go to dhs.gov and get good information, but often these people don't trust government sources. So do we create our own bots? Do we figure out how to amplify existing users' positive messages around these to combat some of this? I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about that.
Right, yeah. So it's a really, really tough problem. And part of the reason that Rene D'Arresta ended up doing this research in the first place is because of the combination problem of recommendation engines recommending related content, because she ended up in a bunch of groups for, like, mothers and parents and neighborhood communities, and ended up getting recommended anti-vax communities. And when she started researching anti-vax communities and, like, making new profiles to look into those, she started getting recommended Pizzagate. And so there's a couple problems happening at the same time there. And one of the problems with disinformation is that studies have kind of shown if Facebook or Twitter or the site that you're seeing this, you know, misinformation on provides you with a notice saying, hey, what you're seeing is wrong, in some cases it can actually reinforce the wrong content. Right? There are studies showing that, like, if Facebook tells you don't trust this thing you're looking at, you might trust it more because you don't trust Facebook. So
the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot there's a lot of ongoing research on it right now, but a lot of the research that that is emerging seems to be that you kind of have to be at the source where the people are and create alternative narratives to challenge the narratives that are happening. Hong Kong is doing some interesting things in this, in that they've recently issued like guidelines for the government to, when something comes out that is kind of a misinformation narrative, they have to produce something to challenge it within a certain number of hours and release it on social media. And that's a way that they're testing to see whether that's effective or not. I think that it's really, really tough to get people who don't trust the government or don't trust institutions like the police or the medical industry to do it from messaging from the industry. I think that having champions and advocates in those communities, right? Like if you're targeting, you know, a specific kind of like ethnic or language minority, or if you're targeting a certain kind of like economic demographic, having advocates in that community who can speak to their experience and speak to the legitimacy of public health and the services you're offering, kind of going to where those people are, seems to be right now the most effective way to do it. On social, figuring out how can you provide narratives to challenge the existing narratives that come from those communities and not from, again, you know, the Department of Health says, but a person who, you know, was protected from disease or was treated for disease by public health seems to be considered a lot more credible by those communities.
I also think personally it's helpful to sort of think of truth as a process, and the way that you find truth being something where you can challenge yourself and say, what evidence countered my current views would be sufficient to convince me to change my views? And that introspective nature of understanding, you know, what sources you find authoritative, what evidence you find authoritative, and starting to act a little bit more critical, not in the sense of mere criticality of institutions, but how you're criticizing evidence.
Sometimes it's as simple as a search on Snopes. Sometimes it's that simple. Sometimes not so much. Now, you asked specifically about what government agencies can do. Actually, the CDC, of all people, you'd think that they had their sense of humor surgically removed at birth or something to work there. They're kind of like the FBI. You remember that line from Men in Black where he says, "Are you kidding me?" And he says, "No, we at the FBI do not have a sense of humor that I know of," you know, so, or something along those lines. I'm brutalizing that quote. They came out with your zombie plan to get you to do disaster preparedness. Now, it wasn't really difficult stuff. I mean, it was the normal everyday stuff you do for the hurricane that's coming, right? Nothing extravagant whatsoever. But they couched it in the terms of a zombie plan. It went viral. So that kind of, you realize there are actual people who work there, and they face these same things. They're irritated by these same things. Companies are made up of people just like us. How many of you work at a company? I'm pretty sure most of you, right? So they can actually propose these things as individuals. We can get more creative about it.
So I think we have time for one more quick question.
Yep. Morning. So are there any kind of like deep learning bot countermeasures that we can know of? Like some AI machine would learn how to flag this fake content?
Yes and no. There was a talk on Monday on is Facebook good for democracy? Sitting right about where the gentleman is there in the blue shirt to your left. She said, I got timed out on Facebook for liking a anti-white supremacist Nazi post. There was somebody who was saying, this stuff shouldn't be allowed, this is bad, blah, 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 about against this disinformation. And she liked the comment about I don't like this disinformation post, and it got her timed out because the AI couldn't tell her from the other people because the content engine wasn't that sophisticated. They're working on that. It's a profoundly, profoundly hard problem in AI.
Yeah, I mean, it's in order to train an AI, you need like a really, really clear training database that tells you this is what we're looking for, this is not what we're looking for. And because of the attribution problem with bots and because of how hard it is to say with certainty this is a bot, this isn't, the training that's happening in machine learning to try and recognize this content is, you know, they're working with a huge handicap compared to the bots that are generating this content. And there is kind of a emerging tools for text that are similar to this person does not exist, but that will let people generate huge amounts of text. So the machine learning advantage is on the side of bots making content, and the machine learning to detect it is always going to be playing catch up.
Yeah, and there was also, I wish I'd brought, I didn't even think of this, but there was a paper that was presented at one of the DC 404 meetings about research into detecting bots on Twitter. And they were very, very successful and highly accurate at detecting bots based on criteria about the account itself, when it was created, how many posts it made, how many friends it had. They had all these criteria. That was years ago. Since then, remember the arms race, they have gotten far more sophisticated. The Internet Research Agency has been, since prior to 2014, cultivating accounts, think of them as deep agents, tens of thousands of these accounts for the purpose of doing this. So that AI process of looking at the accounts themselves, how they're created, who their friends are, all that, that's breaking down.
And now, yeah. As that breaks down, those type 1, type 2 errors go up,
yeah. You know,
and then you're risking oftentimes removing people or flagging people that might even be of, you know, a disadvantaged community. If they're trying to hype up Black Lives Matter content, what about the Black Lives Matter activists? You know, you don't want them to be flagged in the same
yes.
In the same way. So I think we need to end questions now, but we'll be here afterwards if any of you have question follow-ups. This is a good moment to remind you to rate the DragonCon, this DragonCon event on the DragonCon app. And please, if you're Georgia-based, look up Electronic Frontier of Georgia.
EFGA. There's a poster right over there. I'm really serious. I've twice now had to do analysis of bills that they managed to do. One while I was in chemo. I'm in the chemo unit on the phone talking to people at the Capitol. It really annoyed everybody. And when I did the last bill we're talking about this afternoon, I was unbelievably sick. But they were pushing this bill as fast as we can go. I really would have appreciated somebody else to lean on at that time. So please, please volunteer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that.